Washington Post Live's Futurist Summit, The New Age of Tech, is presented by Mozilla.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Good morning. Thank you guys so much for joining us. My name is Amanda Morris. I'm a disability reporter for The Washington Post. And I'm joined here today by retired federal judge David Tatel, by Sarah Herlinger from Apple, and by Mike Buckley from Be My Eyes. And we're here today to talk about accessibility and technology. But before we begin, I'd like to start by just giving a brief visual description of myself. I'm a young white woman with long brown hair. I'm wearing some navy slacks, and then I'm wearing a top that has little flowers on it because it is cherry blossom season in Washington, D.C. David, would you go next?
Good morning. I am a 80-year-old white male sitting in a chair wearing a black sweater. I know it's black because this morning I called Be My Eyes and asked the volunteer what color the sweater was. And sitting at my feet is a beautiful 6.5-year-old German Shepherd guide dog named Vixen.
And then Sarah?
Sure. I am a middle-aged white woman with long blonde hair that is a little more gray in it post-COVID than I probably, started out with, wearing glasses and a navy blue dress and brown shoes.
Mike Buckley, middle-aged white male. I am racing Sarah on gray in the hair. I'm wearing a blue suit, and I could lose somewhere between 2 to 10 pounds.
Thank you guys all so much. So Judge Tatel, we got a sense from that video of how technology has played a really big role in your career. And I actually wanted to ask how that shifted over time for you. You know, decades ago versus now, how has the technology changed in your career, and how has that influenced how you use it in everyday life?
The shift has actually been quite dramatic, and it's all because of technology. 50 years ago, when I first started using readers, because I can no longer read myself, and I turned to humans to read to me. The readers read everything to me, newspapers, magazines, all the briefs and cases that came across my desk. They read 100% of what I read at work. Today, I still have readers, but they read maybe 5% of what I need. Because the world has gone digital and because of technology, there are very few things I can't read myself independently. And as you heard in the video, the key advantage of technology is independence. And I have reading independence because of technology now.
Yeah, that's a really big shift, right? And that's just one example. And to go a little further, I've also heard you say before that, you know, technology, as much as we all get really excited about it, it's not necessarily a toy. What do you mean by that? And can you explain further?
As good as technology is, technology fails. A few years ago, I was very dependent on a Braille computer, which was working fine, but the company that made it stopped servicing it, and Google decided it wasn't secure enough for email, and so suddenly I was back in the dark ages. Just last week, I was giving a speech in Berlin, and 10 minutes into the speech, the device I was using failed. And you can't just pick up another copy of your speech if you're relying on a piece of technology. So as wonderful as technology is and as much independence as it creates, it still has problems and glitches and can cause pretty serious problems.
I actually really relate to that. In high school, my hearing aid sometimes would fail in the middle of class, and that was a struggle. So I guess before we move on, Sarah, I know we have another clip we'd like to show the audience that I think will highlight more ways in which technology is a really useful tool, maybe not necessarily a toy. If we could roll that.
A woman without arms.
Hey, Siri. Set my morning scene.
Window blinds left.
It's currently clear and 71 degrees. Today's high will be 80 degrees.
She uses her foot to pull down a comforter. Now a man with a mustache and beige.
Open weather. Swipe left.
The weather app opens on his iPhone mounted to a wall beside him. A little person stands on a stool and sings in a mirror. A woman signs to a baby in American Sign Language. Subtitles. You are the greatest. The woman without arms taps assistive touch on her iPhone with her foot. She browses images of makeup styles.
So, Sarah, tell me a little bit more about what we're seeing here in this video.
Yeah, this is a video that we made about 2 years ago that shows a lot of the different types of accessibility features that are built into our products. You know, our goal is always to make technology that works for everyone. So there's a wide range of features that are shown here supporting vision, hearing, physical, motor, and cognitive disabilities. And that includes everything from as a part of voiceover. What's on the screen right now is a gentleman who is, was using the device to be able to figure out which door to go through because it reads out for you all of the text that's on a door and tells you more about it, how far away it is, things like that. So tools like that for the blind community, also things like sound recognition for members of the deaf community to be able to get a visual alert for audible sounds in the background, in this case, the baby in the film crying. So really just trying to make a whole lot of features that act as tools and scaffolds for different disability types.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm familiar with some of these and I've even used it myself for my hearing aids can actually connect to my iPhone. Yep. And I know Judge Tatel, you also talked about how the iPhone was a cataclysmic addition to your life.
Right.
Sarah, being from Apple, I wanted to ask a little bit more about, you know, we have these accessibility features baked into iPhones for all users. But one question I had was about how do you guys decide what features to add first in terms of accessibility, and how do you prioritize which ones to change at each software update?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that there's a specific one single thing that decides any, you know, the path we take on a given year. But it, what we've tried to do is to build really strong foundational tools into our technology for many years now. For a little bit of context, our first Office of Disability actually started in 1985. So we've had 40 years of building accessibility features into products. And so as we've tried to do it, to build those foundational tools like VoiceOver for the blind community, switch control for physical motor, voice control, all these different things, from there we try and just make sure that we build upon those for each of these communities, as well as figuring out where there might be ways that our technology can uniquely help, and then figuring out what's that next thing that we need to build.
Yeah, that makes sense. It helps to have started early, and I think it's interesting that sometimes it's those incremental changes that might make more of a difference than you think, than like totally reinventing the system, right? Mike, I'll get to you in a second, but I just want to go a little bit deeper. How do you guys test or analyze the successes or shortcomings of each feature that you develop?
Well, I think the key to that is really engagement with the communities. We believe very strongly in the disability mantra of nothing about us without us. And so it starts with, you know, first off, employing members of these communities within our ranks. You know, we never build for a community, we build with them. So many of the ideas for, you know, where we do move forward come from our own employees who will say, I wish my iPhone could help with this or that, you know, so all kinds of things that come internally. We spend a lot of time working with external organizations. So when we feel like there's something we might benefit from getting a much broader bit of data, we will go out to organizations and work with them. And we also just try and keep a very open line of communication, even in one-offs with members of the community via things like our support systems, whether that be phone. We've had a dedicated email address for over 20 years, and we get tons of feedback through that. Just all the many ways that we really try and keep that open dialogue with the community and make sure that at the core of what we're doing, it's listening to what people want and need.
It seems like, yeah, that connection with the users is really vital.
Absolutely, and so important. Yeah. It is truly about building with and not for.
It's interesting you say that because I think Be My Eyes did something similar. I was just talking backstage about how it came to be, and I was talking with some blind people who helped develop it. So Mike, let's shift to you a little bit. Be My Eyes, for those who may not know, is an app that connects users with volunteers that can help them with different tasks or questions and describe things to them. But Mike would be able to describe it a little bit better than me. Why don't you explain a little bit more about how the app works?
7.3 million volunteers, 150 countries, 180 languages. Anytime someone using our app who's blind or has low vision wants help looking at the soup can, like the judge showed us a little while ago, 24/7, available in their time zone, in their language. We like to think about it as this beautiful merger of technology and human kindness. But there are barriers to that product, right? Sometimes people don't want to talk to a stranger. I talked to a woman who said, I don't want someone in my kitchen, right? And so we launched one of the first AI models to interpret visual information. And if you saw the jacket here for the judge's book cover, by the way, if you haven't bought it, please buy it. Judge, am I allowed to give a plug?
Yes, please.
I took a picture of it with Be My AI, and this is what happened.
The picture is of a book cover. The title of the book is Vision in Large, bold letters, followed by the subtitle A Memoir of Blindness and Justice in smaller text. Below the title is the author's name, David S. Table. The cover features a photo of an older man in a judge's robe, smiling, standing behind a German Shepherd service dog that is sitting in front of him. The dog is wearing a harness, indicating it is a working service animal. The background of the cover is a plain, light gray color.
This is a remarkably powerful tool. The judge talked about independence. That's what we want as well. And so we're going to do whatever we can and put whatever tools in the hands of our community. And as Sarah said, building with, not for. We had 19,000 beta testers on this product, which I think is the largest group of beta testers in the history of blind and low vision testing. But I hope it is. But they helped us build a beautiful product. And so that's our job and our mission, is to foster that independence and continue building products and services that enable that.
And that's actually the product that we saw Judge Tatel using in the intro video that we all saw, correct? Judge Tatel, you want to add anything on that? Or
yes, maybe I could add just quickly about each of these products that Sarah and Mike mentioned. For Be My Eyes, I was actually able to use the Be My AI function. That's the one that is artificial intelligence and you don't call a human. I actually used it to help find Vixen's dinner bowl. It took just three photographs, and you can ask a follow-up question. So it's actually like talking to someone. It's totally amazing. And in terms of the iPhone that Sarah described, and what she didn't mention is, to me, the iPhone, and I'm sure this is true of other smartphones, but I happen to be an iPhone user. If there's one device that's, I think, more responsible for my own independence than anything else, it's probably the iPhone. But one of the things that to me is magic about it is that whatever I need to make the iPhone functional is embedded in the iPhone. In other words, I don't have to buy anything extra. I can take it out of the box, go into settings, activate the functionality I need, and I have a usable iPhone. And the fact that it doesn't require anything extra adds to the independence of the device. In other words, all of you, when you buy your iPhone, and when I buy my iPhone, we all take it out of the box, we can all start using it. That's the gold standard of accessibility.
I do want to add to what Jed said. The Apple deserves an incredible amount of credit for the work they've done in this area. And if you talk to anybody who's blind or has low vision, they remember 2009. When VoiceOver was launched, which is that product that you hear speaking. Yeah. By the way, the rate of speech is fast on there, deliberately, because that's how most people who are blind and low vision want to hear.
Yeah, they can understand things way faster than the rest of us. And it's interesting that, but I mean, everything you guys are talking about, I'm really relating to. I don't have a vision disability. I have kind of the opposite, a hearing disability. But like, when I first went to college, my parents had to call me through video phones. And so like that required me to get a whole other camera set up and everything, like all these extra things I had to buy. And it did require me sometimes, if I was just gonna call my parents directly from my phone, I had to talk to a stranger who was interpreting for my mom. And sometimes the stranger's voice would be like,
hello, I love you. And it was like, what, mom? Is that you? But now I can actually just call my mom using FaceTime with my iPhone directly, no matter where I am. And it's amazing. So there's all these ways in technology, there's all these ways in which technology can be so amazing. But Judge Tatel, I think you and I both know that there are limits. Talk to me a little bit more about some of these limits and where does the line exist between what technology can do and what only humans or Vixen can do?
Well, there's a lot humans can't do that Vixen can do, but that's a different, I could spend an hour on that. Well, let me just mention one example of the limits of technology for someone like me who lives with the written word and with paper and books. The devices for, the text-to-speech devices for reading have improved dramatically over the past 30 years, and the costs have gone dramatically down. But there are limits to them. They aren't helpful for reading documents that say have footnotes. And as a former judge and a lawyer, there's a lot of footnotes. And it's really hard to read a document that has footnotes in it because the device doesn't tell you when the footnotes begin or when they end. And you can figure it out after a while, but it's very tricky. And you can't say to a reading device, okay, read the text without the footnotes. It doesn't do that. The same thing with citations in the text. When I have a human reader, I'll often say to the reader, you know, don't read me the citations because it breaks up the thought process. Well, there's no technology that can do that. And the other thing about it is that it's not great for skimming. I read vast amounts of information, and with a human reader, you know, I can move them along, skip a page, skip two pages if I'm not interested in it. Whereas with a text-to-speech technology, you have to work your way through the whole thing. So there's still a long way to go. It's just to say that we've made progress, but there are limitations. There are many more, but those are the major ones for someone like me.
I'll take that feedback back.
Yes, we have to get the. I want to be able to say to my iPhone when I turn on a document, skip the footnotes. Okay.
Noted.
And getting the engineers to work on that.
Yeah, skip
sure.
The footnotes. There you go.
I mean, it's good feedback, yeah. And I actually think, kind of on that note, you guys are all will. Oh, you want to go?
The key thing about the limitation, and that I think we need to be honest with ourselves about artificial intelligence, there are going to be trust barriers to it, right? And artificial intelligence still makes mistakes, still hallucinates, and a hallucination is kind of when it makes something up out of thin air. And so the way that we've designed the Be My Eyes app is the person using it can roll over to a human volunteer if they want for verification as well. But I think we all need to be honest with ourselves that in the present day and age, or even with GPT-5 or any of these other advanced models, there still will be limitations for the foreseeable future.
I just tried that technology the other day. I had Be My AI describe a photograph to me, and it described it pretty well. And then I asked it to explain it said there was a book, and I asked it what the said on the book, and it said it take another picture, and it didn't do it. Then I hit the button for a volunteer, and the volunteer told me what the words were. I mean, it was seamless. It was really good.
Thank you.
So I guess this kind of gets at the idea that I feel like you guys are all kind of talking a little bit about, you know, it's important to offer both, right, and to have different options available, like not one size fits all, which is important. But then also, I think we hit on this a little bit earlier, Sarah, but there's this term in the disability community, for anybody who's not familiar, called the disability dongle, and that's a term that's used to describe a well-intended, elegant, and yet useless solution to a problem we never knew we had. It's like a lovely idea, but maybe we're not actually going to use it. And luckily, neither of these guys seem so gone in that direction because their products that they made are very useful. But do you have any advice for how to avoid making a product that's not so useful? Like, I think a good example is a wheelchair that can climb stairs rather than just having a ramp, because that also requires me to have to buy like one wheelchair for when I want to climb stairs and one wheelchair for when I don't and one wheelchair for this and one for that and one for that. And that's just kind of like you were saying earlier, Judge Tatel, like I don't necessarily want to have to buy a bunch of different things. So tell me a little bit more, like Mike, Sarah, how do you guys avoid these types of disability dongles, and how do you ensure that your products are really useful for people with disabilities and maybe for everybody as a side of benefit?
Yeah, well, I think it really does come back to that mantra of nothing about us without us. You know, it is about building the with, not for. Because, you know, I've seen many things out in the world or you know, had people come to me and talk about, you know, things that when I'm at conferences and stuff, where it is pretty clear that perhaps getting more feedback from the community would just turn what could be an amazing idea in a direction that really makes it powerful. People are really, I think there's so much desire to do good in the world, and so people will really try and solve problems, but to your point, sometimes they're the problem you never knew you had or really never had in the first place. And so right. I think it really is about getting that feedback. You know, for us, as another example of a feature, we have something we launched this year called Personal Voice, which is about being able to create a digital version of your own voice. And we built this specifically for people who are at risk of speech loss. To do it, we actually worked with an organization called Team Gleason, which is based out of New Orleans, and it's this amazing organization in support of ALS. And there's so many things we learned from the community about how the experience of losing your ability to speak affects you in so many ways. And so in building this feature, there were some even just little nuanced things we did in support of the community. For example, we made it very easy and short. It takes 15 minutes to be able to create your voice, but we knew that people wouldn't be able necessarily to do all of that at once. So you can do a minute or two, stop, come back to it a week later. You also don't have to tap the screen when you go from one phrase to the next, because we knew there's the potential for less muscle strength. So just really trying to work with the community and say what works best for you if you're going to try and create your own voice. That we don't get by having people just think about that in a room. We get it by really immersing ourselves with the communities and trying to understand what are the things that work best for you.
I mean, you got to talk to people,
yeah.
Right? You know, and it's not five conversations, it's thousands if you can pull it off. And this is going to become more acute need as we go forward. You know, Judge Tatel and I were talking, and Sarah and I have talked about this, like the very near future is this technology is going to be available on a wearable, right? That allows the user to be hands-free, which is going to change the game. And then after that, it's going to be able to interpret live video, right? It's great to be able to take a picture, but what if you're walking through an airport, right? With all the data and barriers that are around there in the airport and all the stimulus there. And thankfully we have Vixen right now, but sometimes Vixen, you know, Vixen probably can't read the gate number.
No, she can actually.
Vixen, I'm sorry.
Don't ever underestimate Vixen.
But it's huge. It's going to be, it's got to be a fundamental design principle from day one.
I was going to say, we only have like a very short amount of time left. I just want to end Judge Tatel. Like a 20-second elevator answer. What are you excited about for the future, like with AI and all this new technology, in terms of the next generation of people who are, you know, blind, low vision, have other disabilities?
Well, for me, it's simple. It's that one word I used before. It's anything that enhances my independence, mm-hmm. and enhances it seamlessly is what I look for. That's it.
Yeah,
independence, independence, independence.
It's the name of the game, independence. Well, sadly, that is all the time we have for today. It was just an incredible conversation, and I'm really glad everybody here joined. I hope you learned something. Please don't go anywhere. Our program will continue. Thank you guys all so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm David Lynch. I'm a global economics correspondent here at The Post. I'm going to be moderating our next session, and we're joined this morning by... First, on my left, Amanda Ballantyne, who's the executive director of the AFL-CIO's Technology Institute. And in the hot seat at the end of the stage, Yose Marie Griffiths, president of Dakota State University, which is really a center of forward-thinking on AI, technology in general. So we're delighted to have them with us this morning. We're going to dive in to a discussion now about some of the economic and labor market disruptions that we might anticipate from the wider introduction of artificial intelligence. So there have been two very different views in recent weeks and months expressed on this topic. David Autor, who's a well-known economist at MIT and did the pioneering research on the labor market impact of Chinese imports, the so-called China shock, came out with an essay recently that was surprisingly cheery. And his view was that AI may actually help us rebuild the American middle class by allowing a larger share of the population to capitalize on the value of human expertise. Now, the famous investor Mark Rubin countered in recent days, saying that the disruption that's headed our way will dwarf anything we've seen previously and will be, in his words, bad for employment. So, Amanda, you've studied the impact of technology on the labor force. What effect do you anticipate from the broader introduction of AI on the number and type of jobs, and particularly those held by blue-collar workers?
Sure. I think it's a great question, and I think it's a question where there's a lot of speculation, a lot of different studies proposing sometimes enormous numbers of impact and sometimes much smaller. I think when we think about the impact, you have to look sectorally and also be very specific about the type of data-driven technology that you're talking about. Do we think there will be significant labor market impact? Yes. But also public policy, collective bargaining, there are ways that we can really influence whether those are positive impacts or negative impacts, right? So there's a big question right now about regulation, about policy to develop better and smarter workforce development strategies, and also about, you know, testing these technologies before they roll out into the public. So I want to say, when we think about at the AFL-CIO, how will these technologies impact work, it's really a question of how do we shape policy for the deployment of these technologies. I do think, again, like I said, there will be significant labor market disruption. I don't know that it will be wholesale automation in very many sectors, though there will be sectors where wholesale automation really is an impact, and we have to pay attention to that. I think the bigger challenge for workers and what we should be most concerned about is the degradation of work, the de-skilling of work, the way that these technologies can automate parts of a job or automate management systems that workers are interfacing with. And so job quality, the share of productivity that workers are actually earning, that's something of great concern. So I think it's hard to say right now, is this going to be a rosy future or is it going to be really, really disruptive? I would say it's going to be disruptive, and also we have tools that we could develop to make it much easier for working people.
Now, President Griffiths, there's traditionally and historically always concerns when a new technology is introduced that the net impact will be negative, that it will automate people out of jobs, and there'll be nothing for them to do. Yet, historically, that really hasn't been the case. We create new jobs. You know, app designer was not a thing when I was young, and now it's a great job. Is there any reason to be worried that AI will be different than what's come before, or no?
As Amanda was answering, I was thinking, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, we've had these sort of hype cycle of technology, and these extremes have been expressed, and it never actually comes to fruition to either extreme. We end up somewhere in the middle, and it's a little play back and forth between one end and the other. But the difference with AI, and I would say particularly generative AI, because we've had AI around for a long time, but generative AI is the pace of change. Mm. And as an educator, I worry a little bit about the pace of change. I talk about whether, and you know, the development of human brain, the development of young minds, people's ability to be creative, people's ability to make decisions. I hope we don't defer to AIs to do that for us, but can the human brain evolve at the same pace as the pace of AI development? So I think the pace is what's very, very different here, and how quickly we adopt technologies in the workplace is going to impact the disruption to the workers that exist. There are, of course, solutions, and as academics, we're always working to the future. We don't educate people for today. We educate people for
4 years, 6 years, 10 years hence, so that they're prepared for the world as it becomes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Amanda, you mentioned sort of the public policy aspect of this. I'm curious whether your unions are already discussing AI and its impact in contract negotiations, and if so, what's your ask? What do you want from employers in this regard?
So I think definitely unions are at the bargaining table talking about data-driven technology. Unions and workers really have been on the cutting edge of technology for, you know, 125 years in this country. They're always bargaining technology change. And I think, you know, like you said, in some ways these transitions will be similar in terms of needing to bargain workers both into training but also into the new jobs that are created by the technology. But it's faster. And the impacts and the disruption in the labor markets are coming much faster, and there's a lot of experimentation that's happening. The unions that have been, I think, all over the headlines for the past year, the Writers Guild, SAG-AFTRA, the UAW, the Teamsters, have been bargaining, you know, sometimes specific sectoral things. You know, the writers really bargained for writers to have control and discretion over the use of AI tools, and also to ensure that they're always aware if they're being given source material that has AI, and they bargain to make sure that AI can never be credited as a writer could be credited, right? SAG-AFTRA has a different set of issues that they're bargaining over royalty structures. If biometric data can be collected and then used forever by a studio, then what is an actor's job, really? And so that's what they're bargaining over. Other unions are really bargaining over the impact of algorithmic management. So what we're trying to do as a framework is to encourage unions to bargain into their contracts regular right to consult on both what new technologies are introduced into the workplace and how those technologies can and can't be used, so that we can put guardrails within the workplace to avoid things like illegal surveillance or really dehumanizing algorithmic management systems, right? But then also, as these systems change, they're also changing the way that compensation works in a lot of different industries. And so that's really where unions are also focused. So it's job quality, and it's making sure that the new jobs that are created come to members who might have their jobs really disrupted. But at the end of the day, it's how do workers actually gain their share of productivity that they're using through the use of these tools.
President Griffiths, you're at the end of the day an educator, and I want to talk about the educational aspect of this. You've said that if the U.S. does not create an actual plan for AI-focused education, the nation faces the potential of what you call a very real national crisis that will impact the future of our economy and national security. How so? What do you have in mind there?
Well, if we think about education, there are multiple levels of education. So if we talk about the top end, we have to develop experts in AI, and they're going to develop AI, and they're going to really be the designers, the testers of AI systems, the curators of AI data. Those people are going to be very important in the future. And to maintain the lead that the U.S. has in AI at the moment, we need to continue to produce people at that level. Then we have a second set of AI education, which is for people who are going to use and apply AI, either as a producer of a product or a service, or as an end user of a product and service that's used AI. And people need to have some understanding, just like the previous session, when is it a deep fake, when is it real, how do you tell, can we tell, those kinds of things. And then we have the general population who ought to know something about AI and a little bit about how it works, but you know, you don't have to know everything. You just have to know when AI is being used, when you're being surveilled, when your data might be taken and how it might be used. So there are multiple levels there. I'm thinking, particularly at the high end, if we lose the high end, the ability to be a leader in the actual development and government-wide or military deployment of AI, and other nations, especially unfriendly nations, pick that up, then we're at great risk because they will be developing the algorithms. They'll be one step ahead in the application, in the gathering of data, in the manipulation of data, and so on. So that's really what I'm talking about.
Okay. And Amanda, the distributional aspects of this coming disruption are interesting as well. We went through this age of what's been called hyper-globalization in the 1990s, early part of this century, and it seems clear looking back that some particular cohorts of people less well-educated, less skilled, and some particular geographies, factory-dependent or manufacturing-dependent communities, got the short end of the stick there. Are there policy lessons that we can take away from that experience that could allow us to handle this coming disruption in a more equitable way?
Yes, I think so. When we talk about deindustrialization, which is what, you know, when you say hyperglobalization, really for a lot of people, and I grew up in rural Iowa, that was a massive job loss of people who had good family-sustaining wage jobs often, lost those jobs to outsourcing, and actually, frankly, also to automation, and ended up not in a situation where they could find equivalent work that could sustain their family in the same way with the same level of benefits. The training programs that were put in place were not sufficient to actually deal with the human experience of losing a good family-sustaining job, not acknowledging that people can't just pick up their entire life and move to a new place. Trade adjustment assistance is weak tea, frankly, when you're dealing with someone who's had their whole career in a field and has to actually transition. And then the other thing I would say is that the workforce ecosystem that should build those connections and pathways for workers were really disassembled at the same time. So workers can't, you know, it's you don't just get a job because you have the skills. You also get a job because you have the network, or you have a labor union that's bargaining you into the job, or you can, you know, meet and be in a community of people who have that type of work. So I think we can learn not only from what didn't go well with industrialization, we can look at the polarization in society right now and see that, but I also think that we have the institutions that we need to actually build a more connected and effective workforce system. Right now, I would say we have a patchwork workforce system, and it's really kind of rolling the dice. Where do you live? Who do you know? How can you move into a new job? We could do better, and we can look at countries in Europe to see how they actually do things like adjust transition for workers when one industry starts to slow down and new industries are emerging. That's the call of this moment. If we want this technology to actually make our jobs better and safer and make our society better, it's not only putting the guardrails on this technology to make it safe, but it's also building confidence for people that they can move through this transition and end up in a better place.
David, can I jump in?
You may indeed, briefly.
Academics, we do it all the time. It's not as if we can suddenly adopt AI, especially these new evolving generative AI, overnight. Yeah. We have time, as organizations, as industries, decide they're going to move in particular directions. So at the time we're starting to think about bringing on these new technologies, there should be consideration of shifts in the workforce and the skills that are needed. And then we could time the training, the upskilling and the retraining programs to the timing of the change in the work that's going to be done. We've done it on small scales. I remember having a whole bunch of mainframe programmers running a very fine mainframe system, and Unix was coming along and server technology, and the Unix programmers really paid a lot more than the mainframe programmers, and I had to maintain two groups. And we had to say, we still need you. I know you're dealing with a technology that might be obsolete in a while. We need you. We need you to do a good job, but we then will retrain you afterwards into these other jobs and compensate you appropriately.
So if your phone rings on the way to the airport today and it's President Biden on the line and it's not a deep fake, it's actually President Biden.
You'd be like,
says,
is this real?
Okay, what one public policy should I propose right away to get this going? In 30 seconds, what would you tell them?
I think to understand that education isn't a single dimension and there are multiple levels. We do not have enough people that are going through the traditional educational programs, and we need to reach out into the existing workforce to where we'll find a lot of people who eventually will be capable of doing these new jobs. I think understanding that sort of much broader perspective on education, rather than saying, oh, it's community college, or it's technical college, or it's a university, or it's retraining, it all has to be synchronized.
So we have 17 seconds left, according to the voice in my ear and the clock on the floor here. I'll speak for myself, as I mentioned to you in the green room beforehand, I feel like I know about 2% of what I need to know on AI. If folks in the audience are where I am, what is a good book for them to read, or a good speech, or a good paper that is written for the informed layman or laywoman who can get a little smarter on this subject? What would you recommend?
I've got two. One is a book called The Quantified Worker by Ifeoma Ajunwa. It really talks about algorithmic management and the real potential negative impacts of these types of systems. And the other one is Power and Progress by Daron Acemoglu and Simon Johnson, which I think is a great sort of political economic view of how this transition could go, good or bad.
And I've got one. It's called Algorithms to Live by Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths. Its subtitle is The Computer Science of Human Decisions. It's about the similarities and differences between how humans make decisions and computers make decisions. Very good read.
Great. Well, we have a takeaway from the panel today, and unfortunately, we are now in negative time.
So quickly, didn't they?
I want to thank Amanda and Jose Marie for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.